this session, we're going to spend some time in the Bible, in the Old Testament book of Joshua. And in the chapter 22 of Joshua, we have some very good principles for communication. The 9.5 tribes and the 2.5 tribes, or the 12 tribes total, have just finished conquering the land of Israel, God's promised land, and they've come into the place of Shiloh now, which is west of the River Jordan. And Joshua has gathered the troops together, and he congratulates them for being faithful to God, to following his leadership. He congratulates the 2.5 tribes because they are to occupy the land east of the Jordan River, and they could have easily wanted to stay there when that land was conquered from the enemies, but instead they stayed with the 9.5 tribes, came across the Jordan River, conquered the land, and now they're all at Shiloh. And they have a lot of spoils, a lot of gold and a lot of cattle and livestock and food. And now they're ready to start a new life. Now consider the situation. These people have been living out of a suitcase for 40 years. They've had no home. We've been living out of a suitcase for 2 weeks. We want to go home. It's time. I'm tired, see. 40 years they've been doing this, and now they're home. God says you have a place to build your houses, plant your crops, feed your animals, and raise your children. And so you can only imagine that it's been a wonderful time. God broke the walls of Jericho. He defeated the enemies of Israel in wonderful ways. He showed himself to be a powerful, miracle kind of God. It must have been a great time of rejoicing. And you can almost see them hugging each other and kissing on both sides and saying, you know, please email or write or whatever you do. But it was a great time. There's a bond that happens when you fight together and you have victory together. It's like any athletic team, the same thing. You work together, good things happen, you feel bonded. So we have a happy future together, right? Maybe. It's interesting how things change, how quickly they change. So in chapter 22 then, Joshua brings the 2.5 tribes together because they have the farthest to go home. And he tells them that they are going to have all of these wonderful spoils from the battle. And then in verse 5, he says to them, "But be very careful to keep the commandment and the law that Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you, to love the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to obey his commands, to hold fast to him, and serve him with all your heart and soul." Just kind of a really wonderful exhortation and blessing, and sort of setting their vision for the future as to how they are to follow God for the wonderful things he has done. So then Joshua blesses them, sends them away, and then he turns his attention to the 9.5 tribes. And now in verse 10, we pick up the 2.5 tribes when they, that's Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh, when they came to Geliloth near the Jordan in the land of Canaan. Now that's important. They're approaching the Jordan River. When they cross the river, they're going to be in their own land. But before they cross, they do something, and they do it different. And it's interesting because they don't do it as a result of Joshua's command. So it doesn't come down from the higher up people. They decide to do it on their own. And so now they're near the Jordan, but still in the land of Canaan. That would be the land of the 9.5 tribes. The Reubenites, the Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh built an imposing altar there by the Jordan. So they built a large altar. Now that's not unusual. The Israelites built altars wherever something significant happened. And the altars were what today we would call photographs. It was a way to remember. It was their visual image of something that was a nice time, a gathering. And so they build this altar, and they're thinking that this is something they want to do to remember. Well, they must have spent a little bit of time there, because somehow word gets back to the 9.5 tribes. And that's the next verse, verse 12. The whole assembly of Israel gathered at Shiloh to go to war against them. So word gets back that these 2.5 tribes have built an altar, and Joshua gathers all the people, the 9.5 tribes again, and they decide to go to war. Now, what's going on here? I mean, we were just hugging and kissing each other a few hours ago, a couple days ago, probably. Why do we go to war against people with so quickly? And part of it is in the history. The 2.5 tribes have been irritations, okay? They're troublemakers of a sort. Not bad, but troublemakers. And if you go back, so it seems as though Moses, through Joshua then eventually, but Moses said that the 2.5 tribes are to occupy that. The Jordan River then becomes a bit of a border. So you guys stay over there, you guys stay over here. That'll help us stay away from trouble. And so the history says, there they are again, making trouble. Can't we ever trust those people? What's the matter with them? And look what they did. They built an altar. They've got an altar to worship at. Don't they know better? Are they so stupid? Have they so quickly forgotten everything? You know what? We got to settle this once and for all. And so now, you know, and when you're in a war mentality, you solve the problem by another war. And you're right, and they're wrong, and we can fix this just by going down and bashing their head. So quickly things change. Just a few minutes ago we were friends and together. And so verse 13, so the Israelites sent Phinehas, son of Eleazar the priest, to the land of Gilead, and with him 10 other men representing each tribe. Aha! So something else happens now. And my guess is that as all of these people get in this frenzy, because they want to go home. They want to be with their families. They want to be with their they want to get their buildings up, and they want to get their crops sown. They want to get settled in. And now these 2.5 tribes are interfering with their future. What a bunch of idiots. But we can fix this. We'll just, and you can see this kind of frenzy of getting them. I can also imagine an older person. I think it must have been an older person. Stroking his beard, listening to all of this. He says, may I speak? Don't know if it happened, but we'll use our imagination a bit. We don't really know what this means to them, what the altar means to them. Maybe we should go and investigate. Somebody had to do this. And so this man comes forth with these words, and Phinehas says, all right, we'll do it. One from each tribe, and we'll go down there and we'll see what the story is. All right. So now Phinehas and these other 10 arrive at the border. When they went to Gilead, to Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh, they said to them, okay, now we're going to do a little role play here. I will be Phinehas. I'm pretty sure he's a spokesperson. You are the Reubenites, the Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh. You have to believe that you've done something good. You have to believe that you haven't done anything wrong. People are not malicious, okay? People don't intentionally do stupid things. We may think so, but that was not usually not their intention. So you have to have that mindset. So now I'm going to speak to you as Phinehas speaks to you, and then I'm going to ask you how you respond. The whole assembly of Israel, of the Lord, says, how could you break faith with the God of Israel like this? How could you turn away from the Lord and build yourselves an altar and rebel against him now? Was not the sin of Peor enough for us? Up to this very day we have not cleansed ourselves from that sin, even though a plague fell in the community of the Lord. Are you now turning away from the Lord? If you rebel against the Lord today, tomorrow he will be angry with the whole community of Israel. If the land you possess is defiled, come over to the Lord's land where the Lord's tabernacle stands and share the land with us. But do not rebel against the Lord or against us by building an altar for yourselves other than the altar of the Lord your God. When Achan, son of Zerah, acted unfaithfully regarding the devoted things, did not wrath come upon the whole community of Israel? He was not the only one who died in his sin. How does that make you feel? That's the end of his speech. Now, maybe he had more to say, but he was pretty powerful, I think. How do you feel now, having heard me say these things to you?
I think the main feeling would be the fear that all other tribes are going to come and get us and kill us. And also could be some sorrow and some sense of not justice, because they don't understand us.
So you also feel misunderstood.
Misunderstood, yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. What else?
In addition to that, I would feel frustrated and defensive right away. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wouldn't even want to explain anything. I would just fight for my position or even shut up and not say a word.
The silent treatment.
Yeah, almost.
Yeah, because in silence we can also be defiant. Yeah, but defensive and maybe hurt, fearful. These would be natural feelings as far as I'm concerned. So does that make you ready now for a nice open discussion? Not really. No, it doesn't work that way usually. Tell me some characteristics of my speech or Phinehas' speech. What did you notice, some characteristics or features of how he spoke to you?
I think it was offensive, and mostly you're like trying to remember all the sins that done in the past. You were there like all the time, and you're doing all this stuff, and you're like that, and you never change. So it's more like, say, some of the bad arguments that said you and your parents always like this. So just... It could put you in the mood of the war immediately, or defense or something.
Exactly. Exactly right. So the frequent use of you. You did this. You say this. You're guilty of this. I accuse you of these things. So the frequent use of you tends to put a defensive spirit within you, and fear sometimes, and defiance, and so on. Did you want to say further? Then the accusations, the sin of Achan and the sin of Peor. Those were the two worst events in Israel's history. It's like saying, didn't you guys learn? You're just like Hitler. Well, that's what Phinehas did. He pulled that. He says, this is the comparison I'm making. And does that give you a nice open spirit to talk about this gently? Oh, of course not. So Phinehas' approach to this whole situation actually makes the matter worse. This is not the way to get understanding. This is not the way to try to solve a problem or to go forward together for reconciliation. Well, the issue now is, how is the 2.5 tribes going to respond? They can respond in certain ways. The normal way would sort of be defensive, fight back, whatever. Say, you're a bunch of idiots, you don't understand anything, which, of course, doesn't give them openness either. But let's see what the 2.5 tribes did, because I think the way in which they handled the situation gives some really important lessons to us. So we're going to look now at communication principles for managing conflict based on the 2.5 tribes in Joshua 22. The first thing that they did, the first principle was that they declared their allegiance to God. Notice in verse 22, we're starting now, then Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe Manasseh replied to the heads of the clans of Israel, "The mighty one God, the Lord, the mighty one God, the Lord, he knows." And immediately now, they invoke the fact that we are on the same side as you are. We love God. We know God is in our midst. And so they now appeal to the fact that we are God's children. And we are not betraying him. That is, he is still our God. And what happens is, that the effect here, both groups now share a common ground. Finding a common ground is often among the first, the most important things in beginning to solve a conflict. We have a marriage. We have a history, a father and son history, or mother and son, or father and daughter, whatever it is. We have a history together. I'm your father, you're my son, you're my child, I love you. We have this common ground. Or we've been friends for this many years. We have this common ground. And it sort of reminds us of what's really important, what we want to preserve. And if we cannot preserve this, we will both lose something. So here's the common ground, that we belong to God. Therefore, we are brothers and sisters under God's care, under God's protection. We are not adversaries. Very important message. All right? Next, principle number two. Notice also in verse 22, God knows, and let Israel know, if this has been in rebellion or disobedience to the Lord, do not spare us this day. In effect, they say, if you're right, then we deserve the punishment that you give us, or the punishment that God gives us. And so they were ready to be wrong. They were open to thinking about this, to the possibility they made a mistake. That is so important for somebody to say, yes, you know, it's quite possible you're right. We need to think about this. Now, what happens is emotions were brought under control. You can almost see the Phinehas and the 10 men with him sort of breathe a sigh of relief, because now, you know, they were ready to call the army in and destroy these people. And all of a sudden, they hear their enemies, they're in enemy status, at least in their minds. They hear them say, you know what, it's possible you're right. Let's talk about it. And once you get emotions under control, a couple of things happen. One is, when we relax, we communicate much more effectively. We're much more rational. We're much more thoughtful. We can think. The second thing is, not only do we speak better, more carefully, less belligerently, but we listen. When the emotions are pitched, you don't hear what the other person is saying. You're building your defenses. You're afraid. You're starting to think, what are they going to do to us? They outnumber us by 3 or 4 to 1. They can destroy us. They can come and take all our land. They can take our families, our goods. And they keep on talking, but you're thinking. You're thinking about how you're going to respond. So bringing emotions under control is very important, and that's what happened here when they were ready to be wrong. But keep in mind that in order to make that statement, it required a certain amount of humility. If you're arrogant, you're going to be ready to fight or do something to survive. Then principle number three. The 2.5 tribes sent I messages rather than you messages. Now, I'm not going to read verses 22 to 29. You can do that on your own. But the you message generally is saying you are at fault. You are the problem. I am accusing you of these things. If it weren't for you, we wouldn't be in this situation. So you messages are very accusatory and condemn the other person, and they are finding the other person guilty. But when they're done without any evidence or very little evidence, then of course it becomes a serious problem. I messages are things like, I'm not sure I'm understanding you. I don't know exactly what the situation is. I'm confused. And what the I messages do is they invite more conversation rather than closing down conversation when you make you messages, which accuse and blame. The effect now of sending I messages is that it opens communication rather than creating defensive communication. People let their defenses sort of relax, and now they're able to listen. It keeps the emotions under control. Principle number four is that the three and a half tribes, explain their reasoning. Now, essentially they said, here's what we were intending. This was our motivation. Here's what we wanted to happen. So now I'm going to read verse 22 and following, 23. If we have built our own altar to turn away from the Lord and to offer burnt offerings and grain offerings or to sacrifice fellowship offerings on it, may the Lord himself call us to an account. So if we were going to sacrifice and worship God at the altar, God should hold us responsible. You're absolutely... So there they are again, ready to be wrong. But no, verse 24, no, we did it for fear that someday your descendants might say to ours, what do you have to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? The Lord has made the Jordan River a boundary between us and you, you Reubenites and Gadites. You have no share in the Lord, so your descendants might cause ours to stop fearing the Lord. Whoa, that's interesting. The two and a half tribes, these fighting men, their armor, they've got all of the livestock and all the good things from the spoils. They're going back, and they're not rejoicing about how much stuff they've got, how good the future is going to be. You know what they're thinking about? How are we going to protect our children's faith when the next generation comes? We're going to be on the other side of the river. Maybe they'll say, hey, don't come over here and worship. You do your own thing over there. And they realize that their faith in God depended upon their worshiping in the tabernacle, and eventually the temple, of course, in Jerusalem, but the tabernacle now. And that there, that was the center of their faith, and that's what held them together as a nation and what held them together as families. And so they're thinking among themselves, not about all these good things, but how will we protect our children's faith in the future? Isn't that an interesting thing? That's what it means to be a child of God. We need to think about that ourselves as a church body, as a family. How do we protect our children's faith for the future? And so now they're thinking among themselves, and they say, you know what? What we will do is we will build this altar, not as an altar of worship, but as a reminder to the 9.5 tribes that we want to worship God at the tabernacle. And so they explain their reasoning, and the effect now is motives and intentions are clarified. When we see people's motives, it often gives us understanding. Understanding brings clarity and often brings a change of mind. We now cannot judge you except as you explain to us. Otherwise, the 9.5 tribes made very quick judgments, very quick conclusions, and they had the evidence, the altar, but they didn't understand what the altar meant. They didn't know the motives or the intentions of the people. Principle number five. The 2.5 tribes spoke to the issue, that is, the altar, and did not accuse or rationalize. So they said, the real issue here is, what does the altar mean? Not whatever else, but what does that mean? And they spoke to that issue. Phinehas, unfortunately, didn't. Phinehas assumed he knew everything. And so they explained. And the thing that the spokesperson for the 2.5 tribes did not do is he did not reply in a defensive way. He could have said, you know, you guys aren't perfect yourself. You make mistakes too. What do you think you are coming down here and telling us how to live our lives? We're independent. We're going over there. Yeah, we can move the altar over there if that's what you want. You know, he could have done a lot of that stuff, and he would have been justified in thinking that, doing it. But listen, folks, somebody has to have the cool head. Somebody has to understand the communication process. Somebody has to do the right thing so we move forward. Somebody has to be smart enough to analyze the situation and be humble enough to set aside all of the garbage, all of the brush, the defensiveness and the accusation and the guilt trips and all that stuff, and say, you know what, folks, what's really important here is how do we move forward as the people of God? How do we maintain what is central to our beings, our living together in community, our being one in Jesus Christ, our being members of the body of Christ, and how do we protect the faith of the people who we are and the people who are coming after us, our children and our grandchildren and their children? These are the central issues, you see. And we have to have some pretty mature people around. And it doesn't mean older people. It doesn't mean they're smarter. That's, I mean, sometimes I play with you a little bit on that issue. But God often chooses young people to be the smart, wise one in these situations. So if you're younger, you may be the one that God chooses to play that role. Be ready to step into it. Be ready to do the right thing. To think clearly in these difficult, confusing situations. Now, the effect is that understanding replaces assumptions and premature judgments. Now, that's very important because now the 9.5 tribes had been making assumptions, and they realized their assumptions and their premature judgments were incorrect. Oh, this is getting good, huh? All right, the next one, principle number 6. The 2.5 tribes pursued understanding before agreement. And there's verses 26 to 29. And now if we understand, as they explained, that they really never intended for this to be worship, they really intended it to be a reminder that for us, our faith in God, our relationship with God is the most important thing in life. And then the next most important thing is how we transfer this to our children and the next generation so they too will be committed to worshiping God. And so a long-term resolution is now possible because we have both agreement and understanding, you see. And maybe when we get understanding in these situations, we'll be less quick to judge when the next problem comes along because there's going to be more problems. We're human. We'll have more problems. But also Satan wants to disrupt our unity, and so he'll try to create those problems as well. Principle number 7. The 2.5 tribes pursued a win-win strategy, not a win-lose strategy. We've been talking about that. You know exactly what that means. And the effect is that reconciliation and peace are now a realistic outcome. We were at the verge of war, terrible bloodshed and loss of life, hatred, animosity, killing. But now we have reconciliation. It is among the most beautiful things in this life to reconcile to people and to do so without these things and then to live in peace. Principle number 8. Unity was a primary goal right from the beginning for the 2.5 tribes. The 9.5 tribes didn't seem to have that as a category in their mind, but the 2.5 tribes did. Consequently, God's glory is revealed for today and for future generations. So verses 33 and 34, this is now the 9.5 tribe, Phinehas and his 10 companions, they, Phinehas, were glad to hear the report and praise God. And they talked no more about going to war against them to devastate the country where the Reubenites and the Gadites lived. And the Reubenites and the Gadites gave the altar this name, a witness between us that the Lord is God. So every time someone would go past the altar, that would remind them that Jehovah God is our God, and he's a witness that we are together in worshiping him. And so it became this reminder. And so each time a family would go and they would explain to their children what this altar means. and their children would rehearse how important it is to worship God.
Even a small contribution can make a big difference. Jesus fed over 5,000 people because of a little boy's 5 loaves. Regardless of the amount, your contribution is very important and greatly appreciated. Visit us at www.tvseminary.com.
A couple of additional thoughts, and then I'll open it to further conversation. First, think the best about the other person rather than assuming the worst. It's easy to assume the worst. It's what we called earlier negative attribution or negative judgments. Try to think the best. Try to give them the benefit of a doubt. Assume a realistic explanation exists for what you do not understand. So rather than coming and saying, okay, you guys are guilty of this, you did this wrong, this is shameful, you're terrible people. Rather than doing that, come with the attitude that I don't understand what this altar means. We could think something quite negative about it, but we need to hear your explanation. We want to keep an open mind. We want to hear your motivation, your intention. So assume that a reasonable explanation exists for what you do not understand. One of the things that I've had to conclude over the years in my working in conflict situations is that people do not intentionally do stupid things. I mean, sometimes it happens, but if I assume that they've done something stupid, I am probably making a premature judgment, and that could then be my problem, not their problem. So assume that an explanation exists. Wait patiently and non-judgmentally until the other person can provide you with their perspective. Now all of the data is on the table, motives, intentions, explanations. Use iMessages when attempting to deal with a conflict situation. The iMessage is, I don't understand, I need your help, I'm confused, I'm feeling anxious, I'm feeling frustrated, I'm feeling betrayed, etc. So these are 8 communication principles with some further thoughts based on this situation, this conflict situation in the book of Joshua. Comments that you have that give us some further thought.
Yeah, there's interesting things in medicine. They say preventing is better than healing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the funny thing is what we were talking about before is that they heard that those 2.5 tribes build the altar. Mm-hmm. The question is, someone had delivered this news. Mm-hmm. But that someone was not here even asking, so why they did this. Maybe in the first place, if those who said to other tribes that they make the altar give at least some kind of explanation what they're doing. So they're really this gossip here. So where there's no woods, there's no fire. Where there's no gossip, no conflict. Mm-hmm. So somehow it seems like a root of a lot of conflicts that somebody already heard, that information was delivered, but how? So it seems like kind of hidden person, oh, I just told the information, but is a lot of time you can always put down the fire while you need to be kind of stop this wood or gossip things. It's better than prevent the bigger conflict. Let's say take away the gossip and then that's conflicts mm-hmm. solved.
I mean, I think that's very important. If we can be more preventative before the problem gets so big, and then often serious damage is done. Yeah. I'm going to give you one story yet, and then we'll finish in this session. It falls under the title of conflict management is often culturally defined. Actually, the thought of forgiveness is often culturally defined. And I'll just illustrate that with a story. There was a Chinese lady that talked to me in a conference, and she was having some real conflict with her father. Her father had done something wrong, and she wanted him to say, "I'm sorry." He was in China. She was at that time in another, she was in the United States. And it hadn't been anything particularly bad, but she says, "Why doesn't he just tell me he's sorry and we can be friends again?" She was adamant. And I says, "Well, tell me a little bit more about your father." She says, "Well, he gives me gifts and he's kind to me and he does nice things and everything, but I don't take his gifts and I don't accept his kindness because he doesn't tell me he's sorry." And after hearing a little bit more of her story, I said to him, to this young lady, I says, "I think your father is really telling you he's sorry in his own way, from his own cultural perspective. He, being an older Chinese person, would be very steeped in tradition. And in Chinese tradition, you don't say you're sorry because that brings on loss of face, shame. But you show you're sorry by kindness." And I said, "I think your father has been telling you that he's sorry for weeks and weeks now, but you've not been able to hear it from his frame of reference. You've insisted that he become like an American. And I don't think your father wants to become like an American and do things the American way. He wants to do he's been doing it his way. It's what he knows best. It's what he's comfortable with. And maybe you have to understand his frame of reference." And as I was talking, her jaw just dropped. And her eyes went into that kind of a blank stare as she was thinking. And she says, "I think maybe I need to consider that." In the West, forgiveness or "I'm sorry" is often a verbal exchange. And that's okay. It works reasonably well for us. But in the majority of the world, forgiveness is a change of behavior, which is probably better, because words can be just words. But a change of behavior means, "I am really sorry. I'm going to change my ways. I am changing my ways." And so if you have a choice, maybe the behavior change is the better of the two options. Think of how forgiveness and reconciliation is done in your cultural context. And if there's ways of improving upon it, do it. But don't just adopt the American way. It may not, in fact, be the best way. It's a way I think we could improve upon ours. So, any further comment before we close the session? All right. Thank you.
Now he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will also supply and increase your store of seed and will enlarge the harvest of your righteousness. You will be enriched in every way so that you can be generous on every occasion. And through us, your generosity will result in thanksgiving to God. 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 10, 11. How to give to TVS Ministry. You may give online at efta.org/givenow. In the description place, write Russia Distance Learning, account number 24109-0150. Or make checks out to EFCA. Write on the check memo line, Russian Distance Learning, account number 24109-0150. Mail to EFCA Donor Services, 901 East 78th Street, Minneapolis, Minnesota, 55420-1300. Or send your gift through PayPal for tvs.gift@gmail.com.